A bounty? Keepers can do that? Everlasting. It's not something done often, because it costs a lot of points to do so, and it depends on the credibility of the one issuing the bounty. If they're unknown, nobody would accept the bounty, even if it was posted. But people know me, and they know I can pay. I'll be issuing a bounty of 1 million points to whoever can avenge Corona. My eyes shot wide once again at the size of that bounty. 1 million points, combined with whatever the keeper would get from defeating the enemy keeper, was an incredible sum. I could see many people tempted to act on this bounty. If I had the power to do so, I'd even want to get in on it. Earth Force One. Who was the keeper that defeated her? Everlasting. Savage. Earth Force One. Savage? They were my first defense. Assuming that they haven't changed strategies, their main attack force was a black slime that could reproduce and infect the body of other creatures to convert them. Everlasting. That's good to know. They've likely expanded beyond that point, though. That was back in the first rank, in which you don't have to worry about divine opponents much. However, if they followed the same theme, their slimes should have become divine monsters. Also, there should be other monsters to worry about when initiating an attack. Oldbeard. If they'd started with a slime race, they're probably aiming for a galactic terror build. Everlasting. That's right. Slimes and insects are the best types to do that. Earth Force One. There's one other thing that I remember. The slimes that came to my world used a type of verbal magic, which should be runic. Even if the slimes themselves have changed, that fact should have remained the same. Everlasting. Thanks. I'll be sure to include that with the bounty information. Since we know the foundation of their magic system, people will be able to more easily specialize against them. Everlasting. Sorry, didn't mean to hit you with all of this heavy talk. Was there something you wanted to ask about? You don't happen to chat that much. Earth Force One. I've been spending a lot of time in my world, so it can't really be helped. Oldbeard. Why not get the Keeper chat system? Earth Force One. What? Everlasting. It's a cheap system that some Keepers choose to get when they stay in their world for long periods of time. It lets them access their chat options while descended. Of course, it is entirely disabled during invasions. I blinked in surprise, not remembering seeing a system like that. Was it one that required a certain rank to purchase, or had I just overlooked it? Given that there were millions of items on the market, either one was entirely possible. Pulling up the market, I saw that it was only worth 500 points, so I immediately decided to purchase it. This would let me stay in touch with the guild more often, without needing to return to the admin room regularly. Earth Force One. Well, I've got that now. But either way, I came because my team is preparing another game, and I wanted everyone's opinions on one of the systems, if that's all right. Ariel. Oh, another one. I've got to say, that world seed turned out better than I had expected. It takes a bit of getting used to, but the trees can grow into major powerhouses over time. Everlasting. For a first game, I'd say it was a good success. Anyways, what's this system that you want to ask about? Earth Force One. It's called Skill Master, a game-type cultivation system. Has anyone heard of it? Everlasting. Yes, I'm familiar with it. Are you sure that you want to use this one? Earth Force One. Is there some problem with it? Everlasting. I wouldn't quite call it a problem. However, there is a detail about the system that isn't inherently obvious. If a player with it dies, they lose all of their accumulated skills and have to start over. That is the tribulation of the Skill Master cultivation system, and why it is listed there rather than a normal skill system. Everlasting. Additionally, monsters in a world with that system will become more powerful as time goes on. Any monster spawned in the world has a chance to have access to their own skill tree, and if they do, they will have skills created by the players. So, if a player makes a win-slash skill, there is a chance that any monster spawned in the future will possess that skill. The more skills there are available, the higher chance that a monster will have one. Earth Force One. That's certainly a risk factor. If someone ascends to godhood with this system, will they still be able to create their own divine abilities normally? Or will they be restricted to doing so within the system's methods? Everlasting. Once you have godhood, you're able to transcend the rules of the world to some extent. While you can continue to invest skill points via the system to more easily solidify an ability, it isn't required. Additionally, if you want to start working on another domain after the first, the price is exponentially higher. I nodded my head in understanding when I heard that. Honestly, the fact that working on another domain was possible was surprising already. I made sure to pass this information along to Ashley while asking my main question. Earth Force One, do you know how compatible the game system is with technology meant to synchronize the avatar and player? Everlasting, there shouldn't be a problem. Any memorized spells or techniques should be automatically read and added to relevant skill trees. There was one time when a master mage in my world entered the game, and because he had so many mastered spells, he was immediately given the chance to become a god of magic. With this system, domains like magic or involving certain weapon types like sword become far more common. Everlasting. However, I should remind you that any skills gained in the game are still lost upon the death of the avatar. That means that they won't be able to be taken out to the real world anymore, even if the player's main body has already started using them. Everlasting. Because of that, most players stop playing the game after they gain their first domain, because dying would cause them to lose it, unless they had enough additional skills mastered in that domain to immediately reclaim it. Earth Force One. That sounds harsh. But I can understand why the system's price was relatively cheaper, if that is the case. Ariel.
Anyways, when are you planning to release this game?
You gotta let us know, right? Earth Force One. My team has picked out all of the systems that they want to include. They're just working on putting everything together. This is going to be a full sandbox, so it shouldn't take too much longer. Everlasting. Not experimenting with making NPCs yet? Earth Force One.
I'm not really that confident in doing so. My team is still relatively small at the moment.
Everlasting. That's fine. I didn't make my first NPC until my fifth game, and I ended up scrapping it because the NPC was just a self-insert. When I realized how bad of an idea that was, I got rid of the whole project.
My brow twitched when I heard that. Certainly, putting yourself as an NPC in the game would be horrifying, because it would give anyone the ability to analyze your skills. In a world where anyone could be out to get you, there was a greater need to ensure secrecy. Still, I was surprised to hear the name Savage again, after so long, and the fact that they had defeated a member of my guild, though in doing so, they had incurred the wrath of a rich keeper with many friends, so I didn't envy them in the slightest. Chapter 78. After returning to Olympus, I was able to confirm how useful it was to be able to communicate with other keepers, even while descended. Being able to communicate with the others certainly made things more active, though there wasn't much for me to do in my world, aside from training. Like that, several more days passed, until I finally received the notice of my next opponent, though the name on the notification surprised me. Bella Rose? I thought in astonishment, remembering my recent deal with this keeper. Additionally, I was on the receiving end yet again. When I checked the system, it looked like Bella Rose was fighting another keeper this month, and so he wouldn't have learned about my match with him until after that. I considered letting him know in advance, but ultimately decided against it. There was still plenty of time, so I was content just knowing that my next opponent wasn't going to try to obliterate everything that existed in my world. On Ashley's front, she was making great strides with her new game, saying that she was ready to enter the testing phase. Given that most of the game was created from their code, there was the chance of potentially game-breaking bugs. And when the game was an entire universe, such bugs could be apocalyptic. For that reason, her entire development team was tasked with testing the game, trying every conceivable combination of systems to ensure that there was no clash. Unlike online games in the mortal world, there was no such thing as a patch that would be able to resolve these issues after it was sold. One bug could lead to the entire game being a waste of time and points. Establishing a resonant field. Connecting to the mana core, Tracia called out, sitting before a large console while rapidly flicking switches. The synchronization rate is at 95%. Shall we open the gate? When she asked that, she turned back to look at Chelsea and James, the latter of which had long since completed his energy fusion without the disaster system stopping him. His eyes shined, lifting one hand as he peered through the possible futures. Tracia held her hands over two buttons. If he gave a thumbs up, she would immediately solidify the portal. If he gave a thumbs down, she would abort the entire sequence. His hand clenched, and his thumb was pointed upwards. Right away, Tracia followed suit, hitting the button beneath her right hand. Along the wall was a circular contraption, a dark blue portal forming within it. Rion, having decided to attend this experiment with interest, pushed off of the wall, eyeing the portal. "So, that is the gate to this world's mana core?" she asked in curiosity, to which Chell nodded her head. "That's right. Once we're inside, we'd like your help studying its internal structure. We need to know how much outside interference is possible without disrupting the laws of magic in the world." Rion blinked at that, before nodding her head. "I see. In that case, I will continue to monitor things after we enter. If I sense any fluctuations, I will let you know." As she said that, she began to walk towards the portal. Chelsea followed behind, with James placing a hand on Tracia's shoulder. "We'll take you with us next time. For now, we need you to stay on this side to keep the portal stable. If anything goes wrong, it won't be easy for us to get back. Well, I'm sure Rion will have a way to do it. But just in case." Tracia nodded her head with a firm expression, understanding her task. "Got it," she said, nodding her head to let the group enter. The only ones not present were the twins, who were working to finally stabilize their new energy. Rion's body passed through the portal, causing it to briefly flicker and shimmer, doing so once again when Chelsea, and finally James, passed through. On the other side, Rion's eyes widened, standing within an endless blue mist. Runic symbols and geometric patterns hovered through the air. There was neither a ground nor sky, nor any sign of anything other than the endless stream of magic. When Chelsea entered, she tapped her foot down, noticing that the space below her feet felt solid. Out of curiosity, she lifted her foot and stepped forward, imagining placing it against a wall. Sure enough, she felt physical resistance. Afterwards, imagining that this wall was the floor, she felt as if the orientation of gravity had changed, and she found herself standing horizontal compared to the other two. "As expected, from a microverse composed only of mana," she gave a small grin, returning to the same orientation as the others. Lifting one hand, she launched a fireball spell into the distance, keeping her attention on Rion. However, Rion shook her head. "No change." With that confirmation, Chelsea became emboldened. She stretched her hand out, using the digital conversion system to produce a multi-tool. The item appeared in her grasp, and Rion once again shook her head. "If even this doesn't cause any fluctuations, we can begin setting up the equipment." James nodded his head, and the two of them began to use the digital conversion system to create some large-scale equipment. Given that there was no ground to bolt the equipment to, they even created an entire building to use for convenience. Throughout the entire process, they both kept their attentions on Rion, waiting for any indication that their actions were causing abnormal fluctuations in the world's mana. Thankfully, Rion gave no such indication. She was focused entirely on the mana around her. The many geometric patterns seemed to come alive in her gaze, and she felt as if she had stepped into paradise. There were symbols that she had never seen, but she could identify after cross-referencing them with the knowledge that she had. On the other hand, some symbols were far beyond her realm of understanding. if I were to conduct my magic research in a place like this, how much would I be able to accelerate my studies, she thought to herself, before forcing herself to dismiss such thoughts. Such a path would surely lead to irreparable changes to the world's magic, and may even result in the destruction of an entire universe. After remembering just how much James had suffered from similar scales of destruction, Rian knew that she couldn't afford to take any risks like that. Even still, just standing at the epicenter of all the world's magic was proving beneficial to her, and she absorbed all of the information that she could while the other two worked. All too soon, however, they called out to her, signaling that they were done. Rian practically deflated, realizing that she would need to leave this space now that the work was over. When she walked towards the portal, Chelsea smiled. "Would you be able to ask Scarlet to join us next? We're going to be opening the portal to the Key Core in about half an hour, and having her there would help to ensure a smooth trip." Rian sadly nodded her head before giving it a bit of thought. "But what are you going to do for the natural energy world? We don't have anything like a purely natural deity." Chelsea shook her head. "I was going to ask Behenna, Ashley, Acalia, Tubrock, and Trival for help there. Each of them represents one of the core elements that can be found in Fior's natural core, so between them and the world spirit, it should be fine." Rian couldn't help but blink at that. "But Dale never made the world spirit for this area, right?" she asked, in confusion, causing Chelsea to pause. "Adding that to the to-do list," Chelsea said with a strained smile, mentally kicking herself for not having already created that spirit. "Regardless, the five of them together should be able to fill the same role as you or Scarlet. As for the spirit core, if I'm not mistaken, that should simply be a passage to the underworld. We'll test it to be sure, but Irena will be our guide for that one." Rian nodded her head in understanding. "Well, if you have to do any more tests in that place, be sure to let me know," she said in a firm tone, before vanishing. Chelsea merely grinned, realizing how special that location should have been to Rian. Now that Rian was gone, Chelsea turned to look at Tracia. "It looks like things are going well. Power the portal down to idle mode so we can maintain the data collection. Afterwards, get ready to activate the next gate." Tracia nodded her head firmly, carrying out Chelsea's instructions without delay. It would take time to slowly power up the portals meant to open a gap between the completed world and its miniverse, hence the deadline that Chelsea told Rian. Thankfully, it didn't take long before Scarlet appeared. Chelsea had slightly relaxed the defensive measures around the lab to essentially create a back door for Auravie to bring people in and out. After all, she was aware that they would be playing host to multiple gods during this event. Scarlet leaned against the wall of the lab, curiously eyeing the dim portal that connected to the magic core. As she did, she noticed the red portal starting to light up, signaling a connection to the key core. Once the portal was secured, she began to walk forward, feeling as though something was amiss. When she stepped through, the portal rippled as if it were made of liquid, a few droplets landing on the floor beneath. On the other side of the portal, it felt as if she had been submerged in an ocean of blood. For a brief moment, she felt almost intoxicated by the intense key, before a pulse of energy surged out from her. "I see." She lifted her head, sending a fierce look at the area above. She had created a dome, holding back the tide of ki. When Chelsea and the others arrived, they were surprised to feel such an ominous power bursting out of Scarlet. The Crimson Goddess turned to face them, speaking in a strict tone. "From now on, none of you are permitted to enter this place without me. Is that understood?" she asked, causing the eyes of the others to widen. "What's going on?" Chelsea asked, taking a step forward. "My disobedient child seems to be living quite happily here," Scarlet answered, her eyes turning upwards. "Ki is the energy of life. I rushed in first, expecting there to be mindless monsters made of ki attacking everything that entered. However, it seems that he's already eaten all of them." Chelsea followed Scarlet's gaze, but she couldn't see anything aside from the dense red mass above Scarlet's barrier. A moment later, something seemed to click for her. "Your child, the true martial spirit?" she asked, and Scarlet nodded her head. "When he was created, he was absorbed into the world's key laws. I thought that just meant that it was a natural effect, but it seems that wasn't the case. They've been living in the key core all this time." Scarlet's gaze pierced through the red, blood-like substance, seeming to lock onto a malevolent will hiding beyond. She could feel it hunger, but knew that killing it wasn't an option. As it had become a part of this world's laws, killing it would mean destroying the concept of the martial will from this world. Chapter 79. When Chelsea and the others learned that there was a sentient creature living within the key core of the world, they were understandably worried. Such a creature would be able to seriously delay their research progress if it realized what they were doing and had any intentions of interfering. Unfortunately, getting rid of it wasn't an option. Thus, they could only agree to Scarlet's warning that they were forbidden from entering such a zone without her in the future. After all, these things would be living in the key core of every world, not just this one. Just as before, they began to set up their equipment within the dome that Scarlet had provided for them, while Scarlet herself kept her focus on the martial spirit lurking within the world's key. Unlike when Rian was monitoring the situation, Scarlet was unable to warn them about slight changes, because the presence of the martial spirit itself was causing constant subtle changes. Instead, she simply monitored to prevent any attacks from breaking through her barrier. Once their equipment was set up, she guided the others to leave the lab, thinking that she would need to return once a week to maintain the barrier. Outside the core, Scarlet's eyes twitched, seeing that the entire floor had become blood red. With a snap of her fingers, the liquid key rose up and condensed into a ball, which she absorbed into herself.
"You should place a barrier over that portal," Scarlet informed them, noticing that there was a small leakage of key from the other side. She hadn't noticed such a thing with the mana portal, so that was likely the doing of the martial spirit.
Chelsea furrowed her brows, but ultimately nodded her head.
"Thankfully, the other energies don't have any vicious wills like that to worry about," she said with a small sigh.
"That would depend on whether anything has inhabited the spiritual core. Given that there haven't been any notable instabilities, I don't think that you would have to worry about it too much."
As Scarlet said that, she swept her senses over the area, making sure that there wasn't any lingering key. Only when she was sure that the place was safe did she choose to leave, letting Irena replace her. This time, the research team found another surprise, though it wasn't in the form of any malevolent entity. Rather, the spiritual core of the world was none other than the underworld itself, rather than a simple passage to it, which Chelsea speculated was the spiritual core of every world that used the same afterlife system. In Chelsea's mind, this was both good and bad, as it meant that they had less work to do when researching the spiritual core of various worlds. However, it also meant that anything influenced the underworld as a whole would feed back to all of the inhabited worlds. If there was one relief, it was that there were no major surprises when it came to the natural energy core. While it didn't appear the same as Fior's, it was a sprawling flat plain filled with marvelous sights. From what Chelsea could tell, this flat plain carried on forever in every direction. Once they set up their monitoring equipment in each of the four cores, all that was left was to wait and review the data as it came in. They had already determined that the gravity within the miniverses was even stronger than a size zero world, meaning that suitably large builders could have substantial gravitational pull. Thankfully, the unique characteristics of each core offered ways to get around such things. After Scarlet left the research lab, she sat on her throne, seemingly lost in thought. She couldn't help but think back to the child that was living in the key core.
This was no simple martial spirit with a consciousness and personal desires. Rather, it was a beast that acted solely on instinct. She didn't know if this was a natural fact of its birth, or because it had integrated with such a massive source of ki that it broke its spiritual consciousness. Regardless of which was the answer, the same would be true for the ones remaining in the other cores. Scarlet closed her eyes, considering whether or not it was possible to tame these spirits, which seemed to have evolved their powers but not their minds. If she could, would that result in a conscious control over the world's ki, at a level that even surpassed what she herself was able to do? Or would shackling the world's ki under a conscious mind cause widespread ruin, due to it no longer behaving as it should? These were all possibilities, but Scarlet simply crossed her arms in front of her, pondering the implications. While everyone was going over the details of the new mini-verse discovery, there was a stir within a long-distance observatory. By utilizing signals transmitted over hyperspace and recording the feedback, they were able to get a real-time scan far beyond the limits of conventional devices. "Looks like there's some white noise on the long-distance scans," a feline officer said with a sigh, holding up the printed scan, the outer perimeter of which appeared to be filled with static. "Take a look on the detailed scope in a bit, will you?" She handed the report over to the lichen boy that sat opposite of her, a small smile on his face. He seemed almost shy in front of his co-worker, nodding his head in acceptance. "Sure thing. I'll go ahead and take care of that, then," he said, while grabbing the paper. The woman smirked, knowing clearly that he was infatuated with her. She didn't have any problems pushing off bothersome work like this, since he was more than happy to help her out. "Thanks. Let me know if you find the problem." She stood up, preparing to leave work early now that her last task had been delegated to someone else. Unsurprisingly, the boy did not offer any complaints, his face slightly red as he stood as well. He wanted to quickly check the instruments to complete the task given to him. Leaving the break room, he rushed towards an observation station, where everyone else had already left for the day. Precision scanners were only rarely used when determining if an incoming object was a potential threat, such as a meteor. Ever since V-Day, the use for such things had become increasingly less, and they were now typically reserved for investigating interference in the general scanners. The boy set the paper down beside the device, using it to get the coordinates for the densest cluster of interference that he could see. Without these coordinates, he could look through the machine a million times and never see the same sight twice. Up above the observatory there was a hum as the precision scanner was readjusted. Once he was sure that the coordinates were locked, he looked down and into the periscope-like device on the counter. Immediately, his body went stiff. In the distant sky, far beyond the solar system, he saw writhing masses of crying faces, twisting beasts, and beings of seemingly endless darkness. These images were reconstructed in real time by measuring the response of hyperspace signals, so there was hardly any delay. However, this precision scan was more noticeable when used, so a ship being spied on would immediately be notified. The boy, frozen in his terror, was certain that the creatures he saw wouldn't have the ability to sense his gaze. That is, until one of them seemed to adjust slightly, its red eyes piercing straight towards the projection. He staggered back from the device, a red glow in his eyes that vanished after a brief moment. Blinking, he wiped the sweat from his face, walking over to his terminal and making a call. "Anne?" he called out. The girl that had spoken to him before answering. "Yes, what is it? I've barely left." "Don't tell me that you already made a mess of things," she asked, seemingly in annoyance. "I just got done checking the disturbance you asked me to look at," he explained, wiping his hands on his shirt to remove the sweat. "Oh, that was fast. I knew I could count on you. So was it a stellar storm or something?" she asked, her tone switching from amusement to indifference. The boy looked over at the device for a moment before he answered. Just some space rocks. They probably have a highly radioactive makeup, and that's why they disrupted the scanners.
Huh, I knew it. Well, keep an eye on the place for me. Patty should be there in a few hours to relieve you, she said, before hanging up.
The boy stood there, frozen for several moments, before his back straightened. His eyes became lifeless, and he looked around at the nearby cameras. Turning, he left the room, returning to the break area he had been before. Taking another look, he confirmed the lack of cameras in the room and approached a nearby wall. Clenching his fist, he punched the wall as hard as he could, though the wall was left undamaged. He could feel his bones cracking and see one poking through his skin. However, he ignored this and punched again, causing some blood to erupt from his hand. Staring at the wall, he paused, using his remaining hand to begin drawing a pattern in his own blood. The pattern seemed to resemble a giant red eye, which covered the majority of the wall. Whenever he ran out of blood to use, he slammed his head against the wall, cracking it open and adding yet more blood. Throughout the entire process, his health bar was plummeting. However, even when it bottomed out, his actions didn't stop. Even when his skull caved in, his hand kept drawing the red eye. Only when he added the final stroke of red paint did his body collapse, like a puppet that had its strings cut. A little over half an hour later, the door of the break room opened, a man in a security uniform stepping in.
All right, Shiro, I know it's a dull job, but you can't hang out in the break room all day. Let's grab a drink, and I'll...
He paused, seeing the dead body on the floor. The officer's body froze, and he quickly began to examine the scene. The first thing that he saw was Shiro's caved-in skull and broken hand, looking like he had been in a fight with a powerful warrior. However, when he turned, he saw the painting of the eye on the wall. He staggered back, reaching for his radio, when the pupil of the eye turned, looking at him.
"Hey, Jacob," a voice called out to him over the radio. "Did you find him?"
Jacob reached up to grab at his radio.
"Negative. Looks like he went home without clocking out," he said, in a calm voice.
"Tch, figures. Nobody wants this job anyways. Can you at least order us a bite to eat while you're out there?
Like hell, I'm sitting around waiting for nothing to happen on an empty stomach." "Will do," Jacob said, his eyes dull.
"I found something strange in the break room. Maybe one of them left their papers here when they went home. Come check it out. You might be able to make more sense of it than I can."
"Huh, really? You think I'll understand any of that nonsense?" the man asked jokingly, though Jacob only repeated himself. "Come check it out. You might find it interesting."
"Fine, fine. But the food's on you,"
the man on the other end said, cutting off the conversation. Chapter 80
"Hey, Big Boss Guy,"
I heard a voice calling out to me as I was walking the halls of Olympus, preparing to head out for another training excursion. Turning my head, I saw the Terra twins standing perfectly straight in the hallway, wearing matching light blue dresses.
"I swear, if you ask me to go play with you," I said with a twitching eye,
the two girls tilting their heads to look at me in confusion.
"The girl upstairs said we needed to tell you something," the one on the left started, the other nodding her head and continuing. "They're coming."
"That's not ominous at all. Who's coming? What's coming? When are they coming?"
I couldn't quite make sense of what the two were talking about, but the twins smiled in unison. Of course, their next few words were certainly nothing to smile about.
"The mimetic monsters. They're coming. A lot of them."
My eyes widened, and I turned to fully face them, a serious look on my face.
"Explain." "Big girl upstairs says they're hungry, and when a predator is hungry, they go to where the food is. It's not just Earth, any inhabited world, anywhere with civilization, culture, conscious minds. They're coming." "We just came from solving a security breach in Earth's deep space observatory. One of them cut in line, infected a researcher doing a deep space scan, and made him bash his head into the wall to draw a blood eye. Once enough people had been infected, it manifested in the base." I brought my hand up to massage my temples. How many are there, and how long do we have? For Earth? The twins looked at each other. 8? 9? Right?
One asked, the other nodding her head.
I let out a sigh of relief. That's not too bad.
1,000,000?
The other added, making me choke on my words.
Excuse me? I opened my eyes wide. 8 or 9 million mimetic beasts are approaching Earth?
Yeah,
one of the twins nodded her head.
They're coming from all over the stars. Only the ones that feed on information are being drawn to Earth, though. So there are a lot more out there that eat other stuff.
The other one smiled.
Oh, yeah, it's enough to really mess with general sensors. As for when they'll get here, Big Girl thinks that the hyperlane wall should slow them down, but she's not sure how long. At their current speed, they'll reach the wall in about 2 weeks.
I took a deep breath when I heard that, closing my eyes. Dana, whatever project you are working on, put it on hold. I have something infinitely more urgent that I need you on immediately. There was only a brief moment before my shadow stretched out, Dana rising up from it. She turned, seeing the Terra twins, and blinked.
And me without a tricycle. So, what's up, boss? She asked, turning to look at me.
Within 2 weeks, we need unmanned orbital defenses around every inhabited star system, capable of fighting against millions of mimetic monsters. When I said that, Dana blinked. She lifted a hand and then lowered it, opened her mouth, paused, and then just stared at me.
You need a miracle.
So you call the only member of your staff that isn't an actual deity?
She's got a point, the twins chimed in together.
Can you do it? I asked, staring down at Dana. Regardless of her deific status, the only people that I had any confidence in getting this done in time were Dana and Chelsea. Chelsea was immersed in her world creation research, and interrupting that would cause its own level of catastrophe. Dana furrowed her brows, pacing back and forth in the hallway.
Every direction? She asked, to which the twins nodded. Oh, totally.
And Big Girl doesn't even know if this is the only wave, or if they'll just keep coming.
Helpful, she said in a sarcastic tone, pinching the bridge of her nose. I'll need the drones, a lot of drones. I don't know exactly how many drones, but enough to automate this whole thing. Once I've got the plan set up, I'll start modifying the hyperlane network. If I could add a damaging effect to the outer barrier, I can weed out some future monsters that try to force their way through.
After she said that, she turned, preparing to leave Olympus.
I'm heading to Lorik. 2 weeks out here will give me nearly a year over there. That should give me enough time to make the basic preparations. If anything comes up, I'm leaving Sienna behind, so bring it up with her.
At the mention of Lorik, I turned to face the twins. Are those worlds in danger as well? To my question, the two nodded their heads.
Oh, yeah. It's not as bad for them, though. Space around Lorik and Spica is way less friendly. Constant energy collisions and massive stellar storms make it hard for monsters to travel through space.
I gave a thankful nod at their answer, happy to know that Dana wouldn't be even more rushed than she already was. The fact that she was being given a full year should help, though I was worried where she would be able to get the ammunition for so many defensive turrets, or a field capable of surrounding an entire solar system. Would the digital conversion system be able to handle that much output without putting strain on the world?
What are the others doing to prepare? I asked, focusing on the twins again.
There's not much that they can do in the time given, one of the sisters said.
Thankfully, the expeditions were already called back. Aside from that, there is a ban on any detailed scans beyond the local systems.
For offensive tactics, well, if it was something easy to deal with, the Big Girl wouldn't have sent us to you in the first place.
Although, begrudgingly, I had to admit that they were right. If it was only one or two mimetic beasts making their way over, I likely wouldn't hear about it until after the fact.
How close together are the monsters that are coming? I asked, the two tilting their heads.
We didn't look at the scans ourselves, but the Big Girl says that some of them are spread out a lot, but others are clustered together.
Okay. The clustered ones can be considered the safest. I nodded my head.
If they had powerful cognitive effects, they wouldn't be able to operate in close proximity to one another without influencing them. Those that are the most spread out should be regarded as the most dangerous, because it means that they are likely to have effects that would be fatal simply by having concrete knowledge about the entity's existence. As I was discussing this, I was inwardly debating whether I should purchase something from the system to help me out. Whether it was a specialized defense against memetic entities, a general space defense platform, or even a system that would provide safe zones. The latter would be more tricky, as the safe zone would be the size of a star system and might interfere with the production of normal monsters. "I've got to make a call," I said, dismissing the duo and heading into my office. With a thought, I conjured my chat window. Buying tech trees or systems was expensive, but a consultation from a friend was free. Earth Force One. "I'm back. Old Beard, Everlasting, Ariel. Any of you around right now?"
Old Beard.
"I'm here. What's up?"
Everlasting. "I was just about to grab lunch, but I can put it on hold."
Ariel.
"Yeah, not much going on my end."
Earth Force One. "All of you should know about void monsters and memetic effects. Thanks to my last invasion, I've got swarms of monsters spawning in distant star systems. They're local monsters, so they're not from the void itself. But they have memetic properties."
Everlasting.
"Oh, I see where this is going."
Old Beard.
"You do?"
Everlasting.
"Let me guess, they're swarming towards civilization?"
Earth Force One.
"I'm guessing you've dealt with this sort of thing before?"
Everlasting.
"Yeah, it was the inspiration behind the Hyperlane network that I put in fragments of Ascidia. Of course, to protect my personal security, I drastically reduced the effectiveness of the network in that game."
Earth Force One.
"Which means that you probably don't have the full thing listed on the market?"
Everlasting.
"Afraid not."
Earth Force One.
"Well, at the current rate things are going, the monsters will be here in about 2 weeks' time. I've got my best person working on a countermeasure, but I was curious if there was any sort of system or device that would increase the odds."
Old Beard.
"The only one I would think of is restricted zones. It's a basic game system, and when you buy it, you can designate zones and what monsters are allowed within those zones. It works for a more controlled form of monster spawning, too. Unless you're dealing with a rare monster, others won't be able to enter the zone they're not designated for."
Everlasting.
"Yeah, that's a good one. Though it only really works if you use it from the beginning of a world. Otherwise, by the time you set it up, there are so many random monsters running around, all in different level ranges, that it would take you years to get it running, even with help."
Ariel.
"I suppose mass smiting them isn't an option?"
Earth Force One.
"There's no guarantee that this is the only wave."
Everlasting.
"If it's like what I had to deal with, then yeah, they'll just keep coming, so long as their spawn conditions don't change. You said that you've got 2 weeks, right?"
Earth Force One.
"Local time, so about 12 standard days, if my math is right, at least."
Everlasting.
"Got it. Well, after 5 standard days, let me know if you've got a working solution. If it doesn't look like yours, we'll make it in time. I'll let you bring some of your best researchers over to study the full network barrier. That should give them enough time to add the critical components by the time you get back."
Earth Force One.
"Thanks. I may need to take you up on that offer." After finishing that conversation, I closed my eyes, sending a message to Sienna. "In 5 standard days, let me know if your plan can be implemented in time. Otherwise, Sarah has offered to let us study the improved version of the Hyperlane network that is built to repel monsters like that. It would be best if we can do it with our own methods, but let me know if that is not an option." There was a brief delay as Sienna transferred the message to Dana and then relayed the reply.
"That's fine. There is the chance that the upgrade won't be easily applied with the difference in magic systems, so she wants to settle this with our own methods, if she can."
Chapter 81.
Dana sat in a lab that she had quickly established in Lorik, typing away at a terminal while chewing on her lip.
If I want a turret defense, I'll need to have a wide array of damage types so it could work on different types of monsters. That means an ammunition production plant and a massively large-scale transport operation. If I were to use the digital conversion system, the amount of energy that is needed... She input several calculations, triggering a simulation. Soon, large red text appeared on the screen, reading 00095237. Dana's brow twitched when she heard that. Expected irreparable damage to the world's barrier in under 10 minutes of constant firing. Dana immediately gave up on the idea of a turret defense plan, as the requirements were far too high for her to be able to create results in just 100 days. If she had 5 years, she could work something out, but not like this. In that case, barriers, Dana muttered. The problem with barriers is their unreliability against mimetic effects. She still recalled the report of the monster that simply burst through any form of obstruction in its path. Sarah told the boss that there's a way to modify the hyperlane network to repel these creatures, and she only gave us 5 days to both study the changes and apply them. There were a few things that Dana could infer from this. First, the change was not all that complicated, but just required the knowledge to achieve it. Secondly, changing one node in the network would impact the entire network. Otherwise, they would need far more time in order to implement the changes on a grand scale. Going through her files, Dana found the blueprint of the Hyperlane network. She had originally been the one to translate this power from fragments of Ascidia to the geometric system, so she was quite familiar with its layout. First, she scanned through it, trying to see if there were any areas where it looked like it was incomplete, but that was obviously not the case. There might be evidence like that if she observed the original source code of the Hyperlane network in the game, but that would require leaving Lorik's flow of time. Instead, Dana began to think of it along a different train of thought, theorizing what potential add-ons could enhance the barrier's effect to make it not only restrain mimetic monsters, but even completely eliminate them. Tower sat within his office, looking at the report that had been sent to him. As one of the leaders of a civilized world, he had been warned of the impending crisis posed by the mimetic entities. "This could be troublesome," he muttered to himself, glancing over towards the door. As he expected, the door quickly opened, 2 humanoid slime creatures entering. The first to speak was Atraxi, who was understandably worried. "This is pretty bad for us, right?" he asked, to which Tower nodded his head.
"More so than most. Even your planet is a living creature, so it is easy for memes to transfer among your kind," Tower admitted, calmly.
"Do you have an answer?" Pietra asked.
Tower, thinking about it for a long moment. "If the Keeper does not make a move, I only have one reliable method that could avert such a disaster. That is, I bring both of our worlds into my dungeon instance to hide until the danger passes."
"Would that work?" Atraxi asked in confusion. "Don't you need to maintain a presence in this world as well?"
Tower simply nodded his head. "My core must remain in the outside world. However, I can arrange a significant level of defense for it. So long as my core doesn't fall, the dungeon will maintain integrity. If it does, there is already nothing that can be done." The 2 slime deities thought about it for a long moment before Pietra spoke up.
"There is something that I would like to try, with your permission."
Tower looked over at Pietra, wondering what ideas he had. When the slime god started to explain things, Tower took on a more thoughtful appearance.
"As you know, I am the god of evolution. If I help you to forcibly evolve, would it increase your options?"
It's possible," Tower admitted. "However, you must know that I am connected to 10,000 dungeons that remain among the other worlds. Evolving me would require evolving all of those dungeons as well. Are you sure that you can do it?"
"On my own? Absolutely not," Pietra said with a faint chuckle. "However, Mother is also the goddess of dungeons. If I borrow that power from her, it may work."
Tower hesitated before offering a nod of his head. Receiving confirmation, Pietra focused, crouching down and placing one hand on the ground.
Mother, I ask of you to lend me the domain of dungeons, as well as a part of your power.
Although there was no direct answer, Pietra could feel access to the power being granted to him. With what seemed to be a smile on his face, Pietra channeled his divinity. There were two evolutions that he wanted to grant to Tower and all of the dungeons connected with him. The first was to increase the size of each instance that he could create, making it easier to house both planets. The second evolution was the power to store a dungeon core within an instance. As long as this was possible, Tower would be able to hide with the rest of them. The first evolution applied rather easily, and Pietra actually marveled at how simple the matter was. As for the second, this one felt as if there was a great obstruction. The instance was a mere part of the dungeon, so storing the entire body of the dungeon inside of it was impossible, similar to a snake swallowing its own body from the tail. Pietra changed his approach, trying to make it so only a small gate remained, the size and location of which could be determined by the core upon entry. This time, although there was difficulty, it did not feel as unachievable as before. Tower, aware of what Pietra was doing, simply focused on relaxing to let the changes wash over him. With each change, he couldn't immediately tell what was different, and so decided to wait for Pietra to finish. Thelsa looked at the report that her shadows had sent to her, pursing her lips. Next to her, Petra seemed confused. Couldn't they just perform another evacuation to Fior? No matter how many monsters try to invade, they won't get anything here.
It's not that easy, Sora shook her head. First, this time there is not a determined deadline for the monsters to be vanquished. On V-Day, they knew decades in advance, and knew that there would only be a few monsters to destroy in the void. Now, the monsters seem almost endless, and we don't even know if this is the only wave. Rather than evacuation, it would need to be a full-scale immigration. Such a thing isn't really feasible in the long term, especially with Lorik and Spica handling the majority of the food production.
Petra nodded her head in acknowledgement, albeit reluctantly.
Would we be able to fight them off with our shadows?
I don't think so, Thelsa answered. If it were normal monsters, I would be willing to try. However, mimetic monsters are another story. We don't know what hazards could come from any of those monsters, and there could even be some that could transmit their effects through the shadows.
Even without that possibility, the only safe way to act would be to send suicide soldiers.
Maria grunted, clenching her fists.
You mean that there's nothing that the shadows can do this time?
I didn't say that, Thelsa answered. Let's wait and see what the Keeper comes up with. If all else fails, we can only implement an all-out attack and hope for the best.
While others were preparing for what the higher-ups of every world were calling the second round of the apocalypse, Rian sat in her office, mentally reviewing the information that she had collected from the world's mana core. She felt that she was on the verge of a breakthrough when it came to fifth-tier magic. However, she also knew that she couldn't just go back to that core, as doing so might interfere with the readings from Chelsea's equipment. Though, there was another alternative. A smile tugged at Rian's lips, and she disappeared, emerging within the depths of Fior and clutching a blue stone in her hand. This stone had been collected long ago, and she knew it to be capable of connecting with Fior's mana core. However, she had placed a seal on such stones shortly after their discovery, due to the knowledge that there were special monsters on the other side that were drawn to the minds of those connecting to the stones. Rian believed it to be a worthwhile risk, especially since she could always get a new incarnation if something happened to this one. It might take a couple of decades to regain her former power, but that was fine. Closing her eyes, Rian undid the seal on this stone, using her magic to enter it.
As expected, the landscape on the other side appeared much like what she had seen from the world of the research group. However, there were also changes. These changes being in the form of monsters that roamed between the runic patterns, and giant veins of blue rocks that hovered through the air. Rian knew that these veins of rocks were the other side of the gate that she had used to enter. She did not rashly approach any other such gate, knowing that doing so could lead to disastrous consequences for Dale if she managed to accidentally enter a floor with a very high level. Instead, she focused purely on her own training, content to see that the nearby monsters avoided her. Although she was their ideal food source, they could sense the power emanating from her body.
"If James was able to survive here, then there is no reason that I can't," Rian thought to herself, knowing that she was currently far more powerful than the James that had appeared at that time.
As her mind delved further into the runic patterns, she began to make more and more connections, feeling that her previous theories were all starting to come together. Suddenly, things made sense. She had to restrain herself from attempting to cast a fifth-tier spell, worried that it would cause harm to the area. Rian focused on memorizing her insights, internalizing them within herself, so that she could begin proper experimentation upon her return.
"I'm sure that Gerard would love to see this place," she thought to herself, with a small grin.
Chapter 82. As the days passed, I became more and more concerned about the continuing silence from Dana. I knew that this would not by any means be an easy task, but I knew that if anyone would be able to rise to the challenge, it would be her. As of now, the only news that I had received from her was a report stating that she was trying to approach the problem from a new direction. I wasn't quite sure what that meant, but decided to put my faith in her. In the meantime, I continued to talk with Sarah and the others in the guild chat, and was able to see what their normal conversations were like for the first time. For the most part, the guild simply let the lower-ranking members talk about interesting events going on in their world. For instance, Meat Lover mentioned that one of his robotic societies had developed a new form of energy by refining mortal souls. He wasn't sure whether he should encourage this behavior or not, as it was a highly efficient energy source. Meanwhile, the more experienced members would chime in. They didn't attempt to steer the lower-ranked members in any conceivable way, but only offer insights on the pros and cons. For the example of Meat Lover, they pointed out that such a thing could likely lead to a society where the robots hunted down organic life, treating it as nothing more than nourishment for its war machines. However, if properly controlled with diligent guidance, it could also have a utopic ending where the energy of the afterlife itself became the fuel, cutting out the need for a mortal soul. Every now and then, one of the higher-ranked members brought up a subject, like when Ariel said that she was thinking of making another world to create a brand new species of plant-based humanoids. Rather than seeking the pros and cons, she was looking for opinions on what sort of traits to include in this race. Ariel's world had always been one where there was an incredibly diverse set of races, something that I had learned at the first meeting that I attended at the Gilded Branch. So hearing her talking about new races didn't really surprise me. Of course, there was also Sarah, who chimed in with regular updates on her next set of games. Now that she was programming them entirely from scratch, she had a lot more freedom in what she could make. But at the same time, the development period was extended just as drastically. It was easy to just mix and match systems and call it a game, but a lot harder when you were programming those systems from nothing. On that topic, Ashley informed me that she had done all of the testing that she could for her new game and would be ready to launch it at any time. Part of me wanted to do so immediately, but I held myself back. Instead, I wanted to wait until the current crisis was resolved. Only then would it be fitting to release the new title. Though, when I thought about that upcoming game, I couldn't help but raise a question to Sarah, who seemed to have some experience with the system.
I asked her whether or not it was possible to use admin commands to just level up to the point where you could immediately become a god. To my surprise, the answer was, yes. Yes, it was entirely possible. However, she suggested taking it more slowly if I wanted to do something like that, and spread it out over the course of a few weeks. That way, the soul of the individual would have time to adjust to the growing power. Honestly, that was fine by me. Simply knowing that it was possible was more than I expected. For that reason, this game became my backup plan in the event that my host died, and I needed to acquire the illusion domain once again. Dana grit her teeth, having spent months on the problem that had been assigned to her. Now her deadline had arrived, and she couldn't put her return off any further. With a sigh, she opened a portal, stepping through to the outer perimeter of Olympus, where the Keeper was waiting for her. "Did you find anything?" he asked, and Dana was forced to let out a sigh. "Yes and no. I found three ways to theoretically reinforce the barriers created by the Hyperlane network. However, none of them should be what your friend mentioned, as they only reinforce a particular node. Furthermore, the time it would take to reinforce the entire network doesn't fit the deadline. From what you told me, her method should be faster, easier, and more effective than any of the results that I came up with." After she said that, she saw the Keeper's shoulders sag. She knew that he had been counting on her for this, and honestly felt a bit guilty that she wasn't able to meet his expectations. However, he offered a smile, as if trying to reassure her. "That's all right. I assume that the drone plan is still not feasible?" Dana shook her head at that. "The energy requirements for both the construction of a massive energy field or ammunition for a turret defense would puncture a hole in the world's barrier. The only way to make that idea feasible would be if you created a vein of high-purity mage heart and blood heart at each site, with their respawn timer adjusted to every minute. That would, in theory, create an endless source of power to fuel the defenses, but instead creates other issues." The Keeper nodded his head. "In that case, let's see what Sarah has to say." Tsubaki volunteered to remain behind and monitor the situation. "Is Chelsea coming with us?" Dana asked, looking around. However, the Keeper shook his head. "When I told Chelsea the full story, she said that it was fine to take you to meet Sarah. She said that you would be more than enough to decipher the changes needed, and she was at a critical moment in her own research." Dana felt an even greater weight on her shoulders, hearing such high regard from Chelsea, who had always been the true leading researcher. Even James couldn't compare to her in some ways. She nodded, focusing on activating the heavenly gate. "There's no time to lose, then." 30 seconds later, the gate formed around her feet, and she was able to leave the mortal world, reappearing within the admin room. There, the Keeper was already waiting for her. She waited, having learned long ago of the odd methods used when traveling between Keeper domains. For a few moments, nothing seemed to be happening, until there was a knock on the door behind Dana. Thinking that someone was coming to visit, she turned her head, only to see a faceless man in a blue suit. He stepped into the room, surprising both Dana and the Keeper, and held out a small box. Hesitantly, Dana took the box, which suddenly opened, to reveal a black abyss. Dana felt something pulling at her very being, a gravitational force that dragged her entire body into the box, compressing it down, and then felt another presence shoved in alongside her, no doubt that this was the Keeper himself. The two of them felt the box being picked up and jostled around before being haphazardly thrown to the floor. They had no awareness of their surroundings, only able to feel the confines of the darkness that they were trapped in. A moment later there was light, and the two were violently expelled from the box, a feminine cry of surprise echoing out from the room that they were thrown in. Looking around, Dana found that they were in what looked like a futuristic office, with advanced consoles lined up in rows. At every console was a figure, many of which had vastly differing appearances. As for the person who cried out in surprise, it was a surprisingly normal-looking human woman with short blonde hair, wearing a black t-shirt and jeans. "Okay,
I haven't seen that one before, she said in surprise.
Be glad, the keeper grunted as he stood up, offering a hand to Dana. She took it with a thankful nod, understanding that they were now in Sarah's admin room.
So, where do we need to go to study? Dana suddenly asked. The blonde woman, who Dana assumed to be Sarah, smiled and realized the urgency of the situation.
I've prepared a space for you. Honestly, the process itself isn't difficult to explain, and I think you'll pick up on it fairly quickly if you are familiar with the weakened version of the network.
Sarah guided Dana out of the room, with her own keeper following behind the duo. After a few turns, they arrived at a black, open space that looked like a scale model of a solar system, numerous planets slowly orbiting a star at the center of the room. At one edge of the room, near where they came in, there was a desk that had a console full of information.
I'm sure that you're familiar with the core of the lesser version, Sarah asked as Dana approached the console.
In the game, it's a material called void crystal, which can only be harvested from a few highly dangerous areas. Dana nodded her head. I had to substitute a similar material from our world that shared its properties.
Oh? Sarah seemed surprised. If you're the one that did it and managed to find substitutes, you must be skilled indeed. In that case, you should be able to tell the difference.
Hearing that, Dana looked through the information, thankful that it was translated into a language she could understand. Reading about the core, she furrowed her brow. The void density in this is more than 50 times higher than what appears in the game. Did you use a refined crystal with higher purity?
You could say that. Sarah nodded her head, a hint of solemnness in her voice that made Dana's eyes widen.
A sacrifice? She asked, catching her own keeper by surprise. Sarah, however, simply nodded her head.
That's right. When I encountered a similar situation to what your world is dealing with, I took rather drastic measures. I froze all of my active worlds and then created a new one devoted exclusively to research, directing my staff to descend there for 5,000 years. This formula was the result of their research, the most effective method that caused the fewest losses while maintaining the highest success rate.
Dana hesitated before looking at her own keeper to explain.
The void crystal in the lesser network is what allows the barrier to be created around the network nodes, while also allowing travel within the field to go far beyond the speed of light. According to this design, if a fallen god's life core is used to enhance this core material, it strengthens the network further, spreading out to any connecting nodes. Anything with even a touch of void energy won't be able to enter without an appropriate pass, at least not without having to sustain considerable damage. The keeper seemed surprised at this, turning to look at Sarah.
So, every universe that is affected will require the sacrifice of a fallen god? Sarah simply nodded her head again.
It's possible to forcibly kill and refine a fallen god, but the best result only comes out if the individual willingly condenses their own life core. Also, I should mention that additional sacrifices won't increase the power further.
That's why you only said we need a few days to understand and implement the changes, Dana said, clenching her fists at her sides. She had never looked at the idea of sacrifices, because she knew that it was something that her keeper would vehemently oppose it. As long as Sarah's method remained, there was no reason for her to look into such a subject. Meanwhile, her keeper seemed to be having an internal struggle of his own.
This is a surprise. I hadn't expected something like this at all.
Sarah gave a weak smile.
Yeah, that was pretty much my thought on the subject when I first heard it. However, nothing else seemed feasible. Some mimetic creatures are able to interfere with unmanned technology, so conventional defenses were useless. There are also too many types that can be born, so it's not feasible to have a normal magical barrier. I bet you must be pretty disappointed to learn that this is how it ends up, right?
Rather than answer her, the keeper asked another question. How many universes do you own, not counting your games? Sarah thought it over.
37 currently. And yes, all of them have this network.
The keeper sighed. 37 fallen gods. A weary smile appeared on his face, as he seemed to feel the weight of this information. We'd better start heading back, he said to Dana, who looked at him in surprise. We might not have that many worlds, but are you really going to go through with this? She couldn't help but ask.
If there was another solution, probably not. If it were before this last invasion, I would try to fight with everything I had, he said, his voice sounding more tired than she could remember hearing him. Now, we have the heroic spirits. When we get back, I want you to spread the information via Leowen. But don't tell them that those who volunteer will be selected for the heroic spirits. Dana paused, realizing what he meant. He didn't want people to volunteer just because it would be their ticket to an eternal life. Rather, if anyone believed that this was a true death for themselves, and volunteered anyways, he wanted to offer them salvation. Behind them, Sarah smiled slightly.
I might not know the context, but I can guess what that heroic spirits you mentioned is. That's along the lines of what I did, too. I hope it goes as well for you as it did for